in the bookstore when I was at Pam's up at the register, and you know, the deal with the scrunchie. And we did a couple, we rehearsed it, we did a couple of takes, and we stepped off the set briefly, and Jason Alexander was I could feel his kindness. It was just very supportive and very like, yes, you know, wonderful and nice, you know?
I mean, the sitting on the couch, there was such a comfort in that, to be on that. I mean, that set was so iconic. So I remember walking in there and, you know, any time you could just sit down and shoot the shit, which is what we did. And, you know, Jerry has the flair of cleaning your glasses. And, you know, there were just so many little touches about that. But, you know, Michael hitting me on the leg, and what about that Elaine, you know? So, you know, once again, these guys give you little things like that during the course of a scene. And, you know, it's gold. You know, what you do doesn't depend on you. It depends on the other person. And these other people gave you so much to work with. And
I remember I got a note from Larry David. And he was like, yeah, because I was trying to not look at Jerry for when we were in the booth. Like,
yeah.
And I say, call me Elaine. He goes, no, no, no. You look right into his eyes. Call me Elaine. Yeah. That was my one note from Larry David.
Directly preceding the finale had been the Puerto Rican day. That was a 5-day shoot where I had 225,000 feet of film to deal with. Okay. I've known a friend of mine who directed a major motion picture and shot 150. Okay. So I had all this footage. The finale's going on where they've put a motion detector in my room, a new lock on my door, people couldn't keep pages. You've heard all the stories. On top of that, we were wrapping up the series. There was a 9-year retrospective gag reel that had to be built. So the last 4 weeks of that whole experience was intense, and I didn't go home some nights.
But I do remember at that time, like now I could give a shit, but at that time, being young and taking my craft so seriously, I remember being really bothered that they cut out the pause before. I think we should put him on the poly. There was like a longer pause. Like I made him sweat a little bit. I'm sure it was just for time. And I remember thinking, that's not it. I know way better than Larry David.
Larry has a special, I mean, Larry really had his hands on the tone. Even in the first episode, that comment when Elaine says, Suellen, you know, it's not a top, it's a bra. And I just say the words, I know. Larry really, because I was like, I know, you know, and he's like, no, 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 simpler, simpler. Just, I know, just clean.
And in the letdown scene, he does that thing with Babu. And that's where I just lost it. I couldn't, because I was hearing when he did Babu, your younger guys audience won't know this reference, but I'm going Jack Benny going, oh, Rochester. So I'm hearing Jack Benny in my head and it's just cracking me up. And I don't know if he did it that way or not, but I think we were stuck there for maybe half an hour before I could keep it together. I don't know how long we repeated the, oh, Babu.
He was more than willing to put up with an entire evening of me fanboying out to the point that it was pathetic, bringing wow. up episodes, bringing up lines, all the things I didn't really get a chance to do with Jerry because I was working. But Larry was more than happy to sit there and go through lines and dialogue, and I bounced an entire concept for a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode off of him that he... in his words, funny, not an episode. But it was so great.
We were all trying not to laugh because it was funny. And I guess I was looking sort of super scared of him, and it just was sort of funny, and we all thought it was funny. So I remember that. I remember like trying to keep it together.
His publicist at the time tells me maybe a week before Christmas, 10 days before Christmas, that Jerry is strongly thinking of ending the show. And if he does, he's going to give it to me exclusively, right? So big deal, right? And but I gotta sit on it because I can't call NBC because I don't want to tip this and everything. So I gotta sit on it, and I'm now monitoring it day to day. Is today gonna be the day? Is the next day gonna be the day? And Christmas is looming,
right.
10 days away. And so I drive to Virginia to my sister-in-law's house with my wife and kids, and we're having a Christmas thing there. And you know, basically, as soon as I get there, I get word from his publicist, he's going to call you today. It's happening. So I'm like partly excited, okay, because I now am going to have this huge story, but also like I'm going to be the foul person in the ointment here at Christmas.
And I'll be really clear about this. George divided against himself, and I'm pretty sure the phrasing of Worlds Collide, that's all Larry and Jerry. That's because you would hand your script in, and then they would kind of take a pass usually, and then that would go to table read. Later, you know, the other experience sometimes, which was great, was sometimes they would just take it to the table, read it, which was a really fun experience, and then often then do a rewrite. But they always took a pass on it. And honestly, I can't remember if it went to the table or not first, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
It went through, and so I am more than happy and proud to say that the thing people remember most about it is what they said, so what they wrote. So yes, right. But the idea, the world colliding concept, that was my pitch, so yes.
I said to Rodney one time, you know, we'd like to see some of your old Tonight shows because you couldn't get them. There was no YouTube. And he said, come up to my house on the east side when you and Jerry are in town, and I'll show them to you. So one time, Jerry and I are in town, and I said, let's call Rodney, go up to his house. Call him up. He says, come on up. We go up. And so Rodney is famous. You've heard this, for wearing bathrobes. You've heard this, right?
Yeah.
Always with the bathrobe.
Yeah.
So I said to Jerry, guarantee you he's going to answer the door wearing a bathrobe. And Jerry goes, no, there's no way. You know, he's having company come over. Who wears a bathrobe? He's going to be dressed. I said, no, I'll bet. And we bet a dollar. I bet Jerry a dollar. And we even shook on it. You know the way you shake when you, I bet you a dollar, man. Rodney opens the door. He's in a bathrobe. And we both start laughing. I said to Jerry, you owe me a dollar. And Rodney goes, what's so funny? I go, well, we made a bet that I said you're going to wear a bathrobe. And Rodney takes us into the bedroom, opens his closet door. He has over 100 bathrobes. And he starts talking about them like they're great works of art. He goes, this one I got in France, in Paris, France. I got this one on the east side about 2 years ago. This was a present from the queen. You know, it's just.
I can never tell. I mean, usually, especially when I'm in theater, I'm doing a play and I'm working with my actors and I think it's fabulous. We're all fabulous. And then people are like, oh my God, Lee, why did you do that? This one was just, I always thought I was surprised it didn't go in the fall lineup, as I recall.
One thing that you know, Sack Lunch, right?
Yeah.
The movie. Well, that's me and my family on the movie poster. And
really?
they're selling t-shirts everywhere. And I get a call from Tom Azzari,
set director,
and production designer. And he said, I'm in a pickle. Larry's decided it needs to be this family trapped in a lunch sack. And you're the only family like that has actual kids. Can you do it? And we had friends in from out of town. So I said, sure. You know, so I went out to the garage, put a bicycle helmet on one of my kids and my buddy. I said, here, take my picture. What's this from? Don't worry about it. It's for the show. And and we took a bunch of those, and it becomes, I have the poster framed in my basement.
Oh,
that was a kick.
That is
my kids had no idea. Yeah. They didn't have, I think they just found out a couple of years ago. I had kind of forgotten about it.
The way that line worked out for me was, you know, every now and then you get a bit of divine inspiration. You know, you have a line, or you have a speech, or you have a monologue or a scene, and you know, you kind of figure like, this is how this is going to go. Okay, so you get it plotted out, you rehearse it, and it seems to fall into certain rhythms. And then all of a sudden, every now and then, it's what Rod Steiger called when instinct meets intellect. Something comes out of nowhere that fits it perfectly, and you know, you go with it, and it shines a certain light that is sort of irrefutable. And that line, originally in the first take, I think I had done it fairly serious. I was like, you screwed me again, Costanza, you know. But so all of a sudden it dawned on me, you know, maybe I could be amused by that. So it's like, oh, you screwed me again, Costanza, you know, just he's laughing at his own situation. So that kind of popped out of nowhere when we were doing take two. Luckily for me, they stuck with it as the final take.
And I had a funny story with Michael. I'll never forget this. You know, sort of grabs me, says, hey, can we run those lines? You know, the lines from the sauna. I said, sure. I'd love to. So we're running lines on a set. We said, yeah, come sit here, right? And we're sitting, and he's eating an orange. Doing a couple of oranges, actually. And he's peeling, and we're talking and working, and he's peeling the oranges. And anyway, to make a long story short, we do this for about 15 minutes, 10 minutes, and he just gets up and runs away. And all the orange peels are all over everything. And just at that time, you couldn't have had more perfect comic timing. The first AD comes around the bend, and he sees me sitting on a couch of a set with all, you know, just having made a mess. And all I could do was like point. It was him, and he was like, "Oh, please don't tell me."
What was interesting that I most remember about that scene was Larry's presence. Larry was there. The director of the scene, the director of the episode, as credited, is Andy Ackerman, right? Larry was the EP. He was the exec producer. In that particular scene, I can't speak for the rest of the episodes or the rest of the scenes, even in that episode. But in that particular scene, Larry directed it. And he just sat in the director's chair and watched Larry work. Larry got up and he said, all right, I want this. I want that. Okay. You know, he told Kramer here, blah, 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 you know, and me, whatever. We did a few takes of it and we were done. But it was fascinating just because, you know, it was the first time I'd actually seen an executive producer of the show actually directing it.
I will say that everybody was so clever and so quick and everything. It was such a great group. So it was a very electric sort of cast to be with. Everybody very top notch. So you knew that there was something special there, or I felt that there was something special. And I feel that they thought so as well, like the main cast. Jerry, you know, he's, you know, 31 years ago, young guy, and super sweet, so considerate, loveliest person in the world, really supportive, and everybody was just hysterically funny.
Specificity is very important. And so you don't necessarily have to have the exact furniture, but you have to have the exact distance. And you have to have the relationship, like between me and George, and Jerry's going to be sitting over there. So yeah, and then Kramer's, you have to know what those distances are so you can create something in that. So in terms of making the meaningful meaningless, I could violate George's space and like measure his head with my fingers, you know, like, you know, like measure his cranium one way or another. I could violate his space and blow, you know, violate his space. But I have to know what the distance is between us to where this is normal and this is not. So that creates meaningful, meaningless too. That creates a comic kind of situation too.
You know, here, and I don't know how this happens, why this happens, universe, you know, what the universe is playing at, but I would run into Jerry at like a lunch place or the grocery store or something so unrelated to our profession and random. And I think it's happened 4 times. And I would think, okay, so he's not going to remember me by my name, you know, Kristen. There were so many, I mean, every episode had a different female. But I, should I say hi? Should I not say hi? How do I say hi? You know, a lot of people are going to tap him on the shoulder in the next hour. And every time I said, this is so bizarre that the universe put us in the same room, I'm going to honor that. And I would go over to him and say, hey, I'm Manhance. Because you don't, right? Because you don't know how else to...
Are you, I know. You're forever Manhance. It's terrible, but...
I'm forever Manhance, and I have no other relationship to Jerry. And then I would always say to him, by the way, this happened like 5 years ago. So I guess for the rest of our lives, randomly, every 5 to 7 years, I'm going to come up and tap you on the shoulder and say that.
So I was living in Colorado Springs, and I was a writer, I was a journalist for quite a while, actually. And but I was also an actor at the same time, and I had gone to Colorado Springs to run a theater company, and I wrote for the daily newspaper there. And I did my first national commercial when I was in Colorado Springs, and playing basketball, and I was born with asthma, so it was for Primatene Mist. And my checks, which when I came to LA, my checks for that commercial kept me alive, and they were from the chemical bank. And, so I get one of those. Every time that's I was fair. Low on money, I'd open up the mailbox, and there was another check from Chemical Bank. I couldn't tell you how happy I was.
What would have made it better? At the end, when they're waiting for the verdict, the courtroom changes, and they find out that they're not in a criminal court, that they're in purgatory. And instead of being on trial for their freedom, they're dead. The plane crashed. And at the end, he goes, at the end, they realize that they're walking down the hallway. And they realize, wait a second, this is good. He goes, oh, no, this hasn't been a criminal trial. You actually died.
A little dark, Frank. A little dark.
And at the end, when the verdict comes out there, you guys are terrible people. Look at how you live your lives. I find you guilty and sentence you life in eternity in hell.
That was very interesting because you're right. Compared especially to the other three, he was so not an actor, but it was interesting how, you know, at that time, he's not that. But what he is 100% Jerry Seinfeld, the
producer of the show. Yeah.
Well, not even that. Just the star, like the, you know, the X Factor, the thing. He had the thing. Yeah. So even though he was like smiley during scenes and stuff, he was so powerful. So it was interesting because it wasn't what they were, but it was this million kilowatt thing nonetheless.
I remember going in and reading it, and there were people who went in ahead of me. And I could hear them outside, and everybody was just like very big, very, very big about, you know, what the line was. You boys gonna get out of here, all of that nonsense. And I didn't see it that way. I didn't see it that way at all. I thought that it should be very intimate. I should get right up on them. I need to speak very softly and clearly so that they knew they can't do that anymore. So what I did in the office was I was standing there, and there was a chair right next to the desk. So I remember going in and I leaned on the chair and said, if you boys can't behave yourselves. And then I sat down, said, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. Next thing I knew, I got the gig.
And I watched Jason rehearse a scene, and he had a way of doing a line, and then Jerry had a different way to do it, and they kind of went back and forth, and Jason sort of deferred to Jerry and said, no, I think you're right, I'll do it this way. And they were really good with each other. It wasn't a butting of heads, but it was a sort of a, they were, what's the word? They were collaborating on the way to tell the joke. Anyway, and I remember he would call Jerry boss. He'd be like, yes, boss, no boss. And then on the night, the joke didn't work. And then I saw them, you know, coming down and talking, and I could see that they were saying, do the joke the way that you originally had thought to do the joke. And he did. And then it just, the joke was fantastic. Everybody laughed. And I just thought that Jason was willing to sort of go in a different creative way and try the joke the other way. And then that Jerry was willing to then concede once the audience, they tested it on the audience and think, well, maybe Jason's way was the way to go. Well, I just thought it was amazing to watch as an actor, to watch them both really play with each other and not have any ego about, you know, whether it worked or it didn't this way or that way.
Mick called me on a Thursday night. I didn't know him well. I'd interviewed him once. He goes, David Love, would you write liner notes for us by Friday? I'm like, what? Yes, okay. And it was for a collection of 2-CD greatest hits called 40 Licks, which was a really big collection. But when I wrote that, I had to negotiate my fee directly with Mick, who is not, he's a good negotiator. So I negotiated the amount, but I said, okay, that's not so high. So I still demand a signed copy from you and Keith and 2 free tickets to any Stone show I want. And he goes, okay, just pick the show. And I picked the show, and Larry David, he gave us third row seats. Larry David was second row. And I'll never forget it because he looked uncomfortable, like as his character would be at a concert. Like he didn't seem to know how to, like, you know how you look like an idiot when you shake your head or dance. It's like he looked semi-awkward, but I remembered vividly because my wife, who was still like a young mom, fell asleep during, like, sat down and fell asleep during the show. And I remember nervously going, not wanting Larry David to stare at her looking, you know, being asleep at a Stone show. But I think he might have gotten an episode out of it if he ever saw it.